Right, we are going to get into story structure first, and this should hopefully really help to hang the rest of the course on. It's so important to understand story structure. And I was talking to an editor recently and asked him, what are the top mistakes of authors, you know, first-time novelists? And he said, well, one of the things is I get tons of manuscripts that aren't stories. They are just pages of writing. And it's very important to understand that pages of writing are not a story. A story is a certain thing, and that's what we're going to go through in this first lesson. So these two quotes, I think, really frame the discussion on story structure. Firstly, Tom Clancy, I do not over-intellectualize the production process. I just keep it simple. Tell the damn story. And that's one side, you know, keep it simple, tell the story. And then from Flannery O'Connor, most people know what a story is until they sit down to write one. And I have certainly felt the truth of those words. When you've read thousands and thousands of books, which I'm pretty sure you have, and I certainly have, and continue to read thousands of books, you think you know story, and then you try and write one, and you realise that perhaps you know it on one level, but you don't know it at a level you can do it yourself. So that's what we're going to go through. So remember, and we're going to keep coming back to this, the writing craft is like an iceberg. You can write a novel with this much knowledge. You can write a novel with this much knowledge on story structure, but there's always more to learn, and this is the journey of a lifetime. There are a ton of books on story structure, and I actually, when I started to work on this course, I thought, oh, I'll just revisit these books on structure. And I just got totally out of my depth myself. I mean, some of them are just super complicated. And the point is, if you get lost in some of these complicated books, you're going to forget the whole point. So don't do that. So I want you to start by considering your own story instinct from years and years of reading books, watching TV, watching films, talking with other people, and life in general. So what makes a satisfying story for you? And we're going to come back to this as an exercise, but think of your top five books, movies, TV shows. Why are they so satisfying? What are the ones that stand out in your head? And we're going to come back to this over and over again. So it's very important that you start to think, okay, so what are the books that work for me as a reader? And this is where things are different for everyone. So I'm going to talk in this course about the things that I love and the books that have made a difference for me. And obviously, if those books don't work for you, you have to substitute them with other books. But we're thinking about, what do the best-selling stories have in common? What are the things that resonate with a wider audience? And if you are aiming to sell, millions of books and make some decent money, then you really are thinking about what makes a satisfying story for the reader. And this is a very important distinction. It's one thing to write pages and pages of writing for you, and another thing to think about writing a satisfying story for the reader. And remember, this is not a sort of MFA in creative writing. This course is not about sentences. It's about story, because that's what people remember. People don't remember necessarily beautiful sentences. They remember how a story resonated. So I picked three books here that I love. One is The Stand by Stephen King, and I'll be coming back to this a number of times, which is basically epic, good versus evil, post-apocalyptic story, and resonates in many ways, a story of survival, but mainly a story of good versus evil and sacrifice, and hardcore book, written way before the current wave of post-apocalyptic dystopian books. Lainey Taylor, with her Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy, really brilliant, partly has a definite story arc, but also has really original characters and monsters, and excellent, excellent series. I highly recommend that. That's technically YA, but one of those YA crossover. And James Mitchin of The Source, a book that kind of changed my life very early on, because it's actually about the city of Megiddo and Israel, the history of Israel told through the eyes of characters across the ages, similar to Edward Rutherford, what he's doing with like New York and London and Sarum and all that. So James Michener. So these are some of my books. I want you to be thinking of your own books that you love, and we'll be coming back to this in the What Are You Writing genre video after this lesson. So here are a couple more books, and we're going to come back again and again to the Hunger Games trilogy by Suzanne Collins. So hopefully you've either read that or you've watched the movies. And the movies are great, so even if you didn't read the book, you'll understand it from the movies. Also, It by Stephen King. Again, that will be made into a movie or a TV series coming soon. And recently we've had Stranger Things on Netflix, which was absolutely inspired by It. And so again, stories for me work on the level of good versus evil, plus justice and freedom. You know, The Hunger Games has those themes of fighting for justice, fighting for freedom, but also good versus evil. And It certainly has good versus evil. Overcoming incredibly difficult obstacles. We'll talk about this when we come into plot, but difficult obstacles make a good story. High stakes, so life or death is often an important part of the stories that make it. And friends and family, who are the characters who surround the main characters? So for The Hunger Games, the sister Prim is very important, as well as Peter and Gail, who, you know, are part of the people that surround Katniss. And in Stephen King's the book is about a group of friends who tackle the kind of evil in the town. And ultimately, both of these books are a sort of fight to the death over something that really matters, and the triumph of good over evil, and then life returns to a new equilibrium and the reader can breathe again. And it's funny because actually last night, as I recall this, I finished a book, and it was a great book. It was another post-apocalyptic book. I really enjoyed it up until the fact that I saw on my Kindle I was 98% through, and this book was not coming to a decent resolution. I knew it. And at the end, the ending disappointed me. And we'll be talking about endings and genre specific endings. But when you think about a satisfying story all the way up to the end, basically, I was going to share it with my email list. I was going to tell people about this book. And then I was just left with that was really disappointing ending. So now I won't be telling people about that book, because actually I can't recommend it now. So this is a big deal. The ending has to be an ending that resonates as much as the whole story. So we're going to be talking about all these things. Right. So in this video, we're going to talk about structure. So the overall design, layout, organization, the high level of the movement of the story, so that's in your head. We have a separate video on plot, separate video on character, separate video on outlining versus discovery writing. So what I want to just, how we're going to do this course is we're going to start at this high level, and then we're going to go into all the different parts that make up a novel before we get to plotting and actually writing, because you need this information before you jump in order to make it effective. So we're going to continue a structure now, and we'll come to those other things later. But I just wanted to point it out, because you're going to have all these questions in your head, and the point is that some of the other videos are going to answer those questions. So just take it slow. Okay, so this is about as simple a diagram as I could manage when I looked at all the different three-act structures and all the various different diagrams of story. But basically, the important thing to remember is that this type of structure goes all the way back to Aristotle's Poetics. This is not new. So if you start to read books on story structure, a lot of them will come back to something like this. They may have different words for the different parts. But if you map pretty much any best-selling book onto this structure, you're going to see how it works. So let's just talk about it at a high level. So the typical three-act structure is the kind of beginning, middle, end. This is like life. You know, you have a beginning, you have a long middle, and then you have an end. It's often how we do the day. You know, the beginning is breakfast, getting ready, whatever. The middle is all the stuff you do, work and all that. And then the end is kind of returning to the home and going to bed. So when you think about how life works, the three act structure is just totally, it totally works in so many levels. And that's why it resonates with people. Now, once you know it and understand it, then you can play with the rules. And there are lots of books that reject the three act structure and say, it doesn't work. And this is how we should do it. The five act structure or the seven act or this, and this. But if you think about it as we go through, you'll see how the biggest selling stories fit this model. So starting with the act one, the beginning, which is looking at this, it's like a quarter and then a half or two quarters and then another quarter at the end. So act one, the beginning, we start with the ordinary world of the character. We have the inciting incident, the thing that starts the story. And then we have the act one climax or turning point. And I'm going to explain this again in a minute with an example. So for now, just sit and look at this and hear my words, and then we'll do an example in a minute. Then we move into the act two middle, which is where we have rising action, obstacles, and try fail cycles. So this is where stuff happens and the character tries to get what they want. They can't get what they want. They try to get what they want. They can't get what they want. And these kind of try fail cycles happen. Then there's the midpoint where something happens. And then the act two turning point is often this dark night of the soul. Things get really bad before we move towards the climax of the ending. And then after the ending, after the climax, is the denouement, the return to the real world. And that's where I felt the book I just read failed. It took me all the way up to the act two turning point, and then I felt they totally missed the climax and they totally missed the denouement. So, and the denouement being that kind of that sigh at the end when you're like, oh my goodness, and then the last scene in the film is back to the real world, or the happily ever after afterwards, just getting people back into their day. So you can see how this works. Now let's get into it as it applies to the Hunger Games. Okay, so with the Hunger Games and either the book or the film, film number one and book number one. So the ordinary world, the book opens, Katniss is in her district in Panem. She's hunting for food for the family with Gale. So we know that, you know, we kind of learn that she's part of an oppressed group. They're hungry, she's hunting for food. We also see her archery skills displayed. The opening scenes kind of presents the world they live in. It presents Katniss, the protagonist, and the opposition, because we kind of hear about the oppression they're under, and makes us want to know more. It establishes the tone and the genre of the book. So, you know, and I come in later videos, I'll talk more about, you know, sort of the opening paragraph and different how the plot works in detail. But for now, just mapping it onto this structure, the thinking about the ordinary world is Katniss has to hunt to feed her family, and they're in this district in Panem. So ordinary world. Then the inciting incident is that they go along to the reaping, and, you know, if it's part of your norm, if the reaping is part of normal life, then basically every year, people are picked, people die, and you just carry on, you know, that's what happens. But then her sister, Prim, is picked for the reaping. Now, that's the inciting incident, because that's the thing that knocks Katniss out of her ordinary world. She can't just carry on. She has to make a decision then, and she makes a decision, which is that she will volunteer for the games. So the inciting incident has set her on a course. Now we have the story, because the story is not, Katniss is in Panem trying to survive. That would be another story. But this one, a story that maps this type of story structure, is she has to, in the inciting incident, she has to make a decision. Do I let Prim go and die, or volunteer for her and then go into the games myself? And the answer to the story is then, does Katniss survive the games? So you can see there how we've already done those two things, and you need to have these things in your story. So then we get into the act one climax. Kind of the turning point is there's always these two tributes, and this is, you know, whether this is the climax or turning point is kind of negotiable here, but the fact is now it's made life even more complicated because Peter loves her, so he's not just another tribute. She now feels she has to stay alive and keep him alive. You know, there is not just only one survivor in this game, or she doesn't want it to be. So can she stay alive and keep him alive? Then, I mean, most of the Hunger Games is the act two escalating conflict and the try-fail cycles. And try-fail cycle is just, you know, the character tries to get what they want to win the games. They fail. They try again, they fail. And in the games, if you've read the book or seen the film, you'll know that, you know, there's various complications along the way. There's, you know, the buzzy wasp things, his name I can't remember. There's the other characters wanting to kill her. There's Peter getting hurt. There's all these different things that are external conflicts and also internal conflicts for Katniss. And we'll come back to conflict when we delve into plot. But for now, I want you to see that The Hunger Games is a classic example of this story structure. So you've got this rising action, try-fail cycles where, you know, things happen, she fails, things happen, she fails. And we keep going with her, and then we're like, oh no, you know, and then we're like, oh, and then oh no, like she finds a friend in Prue, I think it's Prue, and then she dies, you know, and or she hasn't got her bow and arrow, so she has to get the bow and arrow, that type of thing. So this rising action is, things are very difficult for the character, we have to keep following them. As a reader, we're like, oh, what's gonna happen next, you know. Then the midpoint is essentially she was going along in one way, which is I'm independent, I'm on my own. And then Peter saves her life. And even though she thought he'd allied with the others, so it's like a trick. He's trying to keep her alive. And she's like, what? So it's almost a kind of reversal again into she now, you know, she and Peter will end up hopefully together. So then, you know, we get the Dark Night of the Soul moment where Rue is killed. The games are getting worse. It seems like she's going to die. They're just not going to make it. The Dark Night of the Soul, I think it literally is a dark night. You know, she's like up in the tree and, you know, she could just lay down and die, basically. But she goes, basically, I'm going to do it. She recommits. She's going to make it. And she fights to the bitter end. So that the Dark Night of the Soul before the climax, and this, the climax is that they're fighting for this. They're fighting their way up to the top. And the mutts come, the genetically modified mutts with the faces of the other tributes, which is quite horrible. It's actually worse in the book than the film, I think. But they fight their way and it reaches their peak and we think they've won. And then we go even further. It's like, no, there can be only one winner. And then Katniss takes the berries and basically they're both going to kill themselves. So there's conflict right up to the very end, that reversal where she has to, you know, you think they've won and then they haven't won. The rules are change. But then they change it back again. That's what's called a reversal. So there's conflict to the end. But the fact is, the story question, which was started with the inciting incident, will Katniss survive the games? The obligatory scene is, yes, she has now won the games. You have to answer the story question. And that's what this editor was getting at when he said that often writers will send him a pile of paper that is a load of writing, but it's not a story. So this is why we're starting here, because if you don't understand the story structure, all the rest will get you to a point where your books won't necessarily resonate, either with an agent or a publisher or a reader. So we're not, you know, we're not caring at the moment how you want to publish. We're caring about how you're going to write a story that resonates. And this stuff you will keep coming back to, I promise. And you might think, oh, it's constricting, but it's not. It will actually really, really help you. And then the resolution is, you know, the denouement, the kind of, and now, of course, this is a trilogy, but the end of book one is, okay, they return to the real world. They go back to the winner's village in the district. And you think that might be it. But of course, with the trilogy, we then, you know, it could have ended like that. But of course, there's a bigger trilogy, which is that, you know, we end up going against President Snow and taking the world. But in this particular story arc, we've resolved the story question and Katniss has returned to the real world. Yes, she has changed significantly from the girl she was. She has rescued her family and now they're living in this nice house. But then there's the bigger story of what does it mean? So I hope you can see that that this maps onto this structure, and it doesn't have to be complicated. You know, what we've just done there is an outline almost of the whole story, and a reverse outline, if you like, which fits onto this structure. And the reason I like using the Hunger Games is it's such an obvious example of this structure. It's brilliant, and also it's brilliantly written, and it sold millions of copies and made Suzanne Collins lots of money and made it, you know, became a film, and readers all over the world say it's one of their favourite books ever. So, you know, it is the definition of a very successful book. So just a couple of other things, because I know you will have heard of some of these other examples of structure. So I wanted to mention them. So one is the hero's journey. And this book by Christopher Vogler is quite good. The mythic structure for writers. And actually, I've given you a link here to a diagram which maps the arch plot classic design against the hero's journey. But basically, it's very similar. The hero's journey fits over the three act structure, but it has some more metaphor in it. So a call to adventure is just the inciting incident and the rejection of the call and then the appearance of the mentor. But if you map something like Star Wars, which is considered a perfect example of the hero's journey, you'll see that it also fits over that three-act structure. So the point is that a story is a journey that the reader is coming on with you. And if it unfolds in the right way, if it unfolds according to the rules of story, it will resonate deeply within them. And that is what we want. We want people to go, oh my goodness, I feel complete by the end of the book. And if you can make people feel that that is a good story, that's just going to be amazing. Because when things happen at the wrong times, the reader feels it and they feel a dissatisfaction even if they don't know why. So the book I just mentioned, you know, if I didn't know anything about story structure, I would have just put down the book and gone, oh, you know, I'm disappointed by that. I don't really know why. I didn't really like the ending. But when I look at the story structure, I can go, okay, I know why that didn't satisfy me, because it almost stopped in act two. There was no climax and there was no denouement. I don't feel that there was a satisfying resolution to that story. Now, whether it is a story because it doesn't actually finish is the question. It felt like there should have been a second book in the series, or that the author just ran out of time to fulfill a publishing contract or something. But the fact is that there are books that you will know about that feel that way. And in fact, I'll mention one that doesn't do it for me by Stephen King, the great Stephen King, who I love. Under the Dome, if you've not watched the pro TV program, if you've read the book, the ending of Under the Dome totally dissatisfied me, mainly because it felt like a genre twist instead of a satisfying resolution. Compare that to a book like The Shining, which has a perfect story arc and a very clear resolution that satisfies me, in the same way it has a very satisfying ending. So even the greats can get things wrong. But again, that might be a personal preference. You might love Under the Dome. But this is the thing. If you read other books on story structure, you will find that they do fit this type of, certainly this type of graph. Because this type of graph is what, I say graph, you know, this type of design is what makes a story satisfying for the reader. And that's what we want. So a book that I also quite like, Plot and Structure by James Scott Bell. And this point is sort of explaining the getting between the acts. And he says, rather than calling these plot points, I find it helpful to think of these two transitions as doorways of no return. So every story has a disturbance, which is the inciting incident, the thing that thrusts the character into the story, and two doorways of no return, as in once they make this choice, then they're really committed and there has to be some kind of choice. So coming up with these things is plotting, and we will obviously have a separate video on plot in terms of coming up with plot ideas, and we also have a separate video on outlining, which is working out the plot. Now, there are examples of stories which are told in a different design. These are non-linear stories, so telling the story out of order. So two examples of non-linear stories, The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger, which is a really good book. I really enjoyed it. And also the film Memento. Now, absolutely, you can do non-linear stories, but I suggest with your first book, you just consider sticking to a linear plot and the kind of classic story design. And once you've mastered that, you can do other things. So remember, we're keeping the idea of that iceberg in mind. And so you want to keep it simple, do what you need to do to get the first book done, and think about doing different things later. Okay, so let's start to talk about genre and structure, conventions and obligatory scenes. And then in the next video, we're going to be talking about what are you writing, and we'll go much more into genre. But this book, The Story Grid, is an excellent book to also think about story structure. But again, these books can be quite complicated. And what I don't want you to do is get lost in story structure books before you get into, you know, writing your first novel, because you might just find it all too complicated. But I just wanted to explain a couple of things about genre conventions and obligatory scenes. So when we're talking about genre, we're talking about what type of book you're writing. And these are some of the obligatory scenes and things that have to happen in order to satisfy your reader. So a murder mystery or a crime novel, you know, there's usually a dead body found, and we have to work out who did it and why they did it. The plot will consist of clues and suspects. So the try-fail cycles are: this is a suspect, we pursue the suspect, it's never the first suspect. We do that until the perpetrator, the person who did it, is confronted, and we find out who did it and why, and then justice is done or not. And usually justice is done. It might not be a legal justice, but the person who did it will get a comeuppance in some way. Now, this, you know, you can see this structure in a TV show Castle, which I quite like, used to like before the two characters got together. Or even something like House, the TV show House, which even though it was not so much a murder mystery, it was, because actually what they had was a person comes in with a strange disease. What disease is it? And then they will follow a particular thing, and it's never the first thing they come up with. It's usually not the second thing they come up with, and it normally is the third thing they come up with. So it actually works with the try-fail cycles with a TV program like House, and it is a kind of murder mystery. And there's a ticking clock, and they have to get it done. And is justice done? Is there a resolution? Do we find out why? Are they saved or not? So you can see how the story structure works in TV episodes as well as films. With an action thriller, the type of thing I tend to write, there's a ticking clock. So there's always a deadline. So that really keeps the pace moving. There's always a hero at the mercy of the villain scene. And again, classic James Bond. If you follow the James Bond story arcs, it will be the three-act structure. But we always have the hero at the mercy of the villain. You know, when James Bond is, tied up and there's the laser between his legs. I think that was a Sean Connery film. And it's like, you know, and he's about to die, and then suddenly he manages to break out and then kill the villain. So we always have to have that hero at the mercy of the villain, and then the reversal as they escape. And then sometimes we get that extra, you know, in horror movies, you always know that the bad guy is going to somehow reemerge from the, you've just drowned the bad guy, but they're going to reemerge from the water, and they've just one last lunge to try and kill you before they die and sink to the depths. So that's that's a horror trope, but that is a horror convention, that the bad guy has to have one last go. High stakes, again, in action thrillers, always high stakes, often life or death. And then kind of taking things back to a sort of romance, there's always two people meet, often called the meet cute. Somehow two people meet, whether it's two guys, two girls, a man and a woman, dog and a cat, whatever you like. Two people meet. There's conflict. So the try-fail cycles are, I hate him. I'm a power lawyer and he's the green activist and he's trying to stop me, and we meet at a, you know, he's trying to protest at my event, and we meet and we hate each other, and then we go into the courtroom and, you know, there's drama and there's conflict, but actually we're attracted to each other. And then there's always a first kiss scene, and with a romance there's a happily ever after. So somehow, you know, maybe the high-powered lawyer decides that this guy's worth giving up high-poweredness for and becomes a green activist too, or he becomes a high-powered lawyer, or they just manage to get along. So there's always got to be a happily ever after, an HEA, if you're writing a romance. And if there isn't, then your romance reader will be disappointed. And again, we'll come back to genre in a minute, but I want you to start thinking about, on top of the three-act structure, is the conventions of the genre you're writing. And Sean Coyne, great quote here, write for the genre nerds desperate for new stories. Because, I mean, like, I'm a big action thriller reader, and I read sort of on the edge of horror as well, and some murder mystery, but mainly action thriller, horror books. I read other things, sci-fi, fantasy, post-apocalyptic, etc. But I'm always desperate for an action thriller that actually satisfies me, because so many of them don't. So that's who you want to write for, people who are desperate for new stories in a genre they love. And this is why romance readers are amazing, because they read so fast and they're always wanting more romances that satisfy them. And if people find, you know, I hope that you're thinking about what you want to do on a bigger scale in terms of your writing career. It might not just be one novel, it could be the rest of your life, like it is for me, and I love it. You know, if you get the bug, you'll be writing more books. So what you want is to satisfy readers enough that they buy your next book, and that's how you make a career. So layer these genre conventions on top of that three-act structure. So just coming back to the sort of what some people might be thinking, which is, won't this make cliche stories? I want to write something original. I want to stand out. And yes, we all want to stand out. I certainly do. One of my creative goals, I mean, I have a financial goal, is make a very good living, which I already do, and I have financial goals. But a creative goal for me is to write something that people recommend as much as I recommend The Stand by Stephen King. I want to write a book like that, that changes people's perception, or that is in their memory. And when people say, what is your favorite book, and I say The Stand by Stephen King, I want people in the future to say it's X by J.F. Penn. So I want to write an original story, but to be original, you still need to fit into a structure. And actually, you can be more creative within boundaries. As T.S. Eliot said, when forced to work within a strict framework, the imagination is taxed to its utmost and will produce its richest ideas. Given total freedom, the work is likely to sprawl. And this is the problem with many writers, especially first novelists, is that they think they have total freedom, and then they just write pages. So pages of writing are not a story. Pages of writing are not a book. And this is like a real penny drop moment, I hope, for many of you. If you're not writing to some kind of framework, then you may just end up with something that goes all over the place, and nobody wants to read. An agent will put it down as soon as they've started reading, a publisher will put it down, a reader will put it down, and that's not what we want. So use this structure as a guideline to help you create, and if you've already started writing or you already have books, you can map those onto this structure and see what you're missing, and it will seriously help you. And of course, we'll come back to this when we do plot and plotting and outlining, but I just wanted to talk about it now as well. Okay, so we're now going to think about, we're going to move away from the overarching diagram of story structure and talk about structure in terms of scenes. Now, this was a massive writing breakthrough for me. When I understood what a scene was, I was able to write the book. Like, it seriously was such a big deal for me, and it made a huge difference in my own stories. I literally couldn't do it before. Like, I think we all get het up with chapters, and I'll come back to chapters versus scenes. But when you're actually writing your first draft, you are writing in scenes. So again, two books here. Larry Brooks' Story Engineering is very good, and The Story Grid by Sean Coyne, which I've already mentioned. So just coming back to what a scene is. So a scene has setting. So it's in a place and it's at a specific time. Now, we're going to do a whole video on setting, but you know, let's say, and I've taken my book here, Crypt of Bone. So the prologue is actually, it's set in Israel, it's set in Jerusalem by the Western Wall. The time is an early morning, and it's the present day. So it's the real world, you know, and it is the Western Wall in Jerusalem, Israel. So a specific time and a specific place, that immediately changes if you say my setting is a spaceship out in the far XX nebula at you know, in 3000 AD, so you know, over 1,000 years time. That's a sci-fi novel, you know. Or if it's you know, it's a Scottish palace or a Scottish stately home in 1850, then immediately, just by coming up with a setting and a time and a place, you are changing what your story is going to be. You're changing so much about what the scene could be. So that's one thing. It must have a point of view. So this is the character. So who is the character who's going to be part of it? Who is telling the story? And again, we'll come back to point of view. But the point of view is, which character are you telling this through? So taking the castle in Scotland in 1850 or something, are you telling the story from the point of view of the queen, or the noble woman, or are you telling it from the perspective of the scullery maid? And which viewpoint, or the lord of the castle, or somebody who's about to, the Highlander who's about to invade the castle, you know, and this could turn into a romance or a thriller, you know, set in a historical period. So as soon as you choose the character and whose viewpoint you're going to show it through. So my prologue there, where I've put prophet jump. So basically a patient from a mental hospital jumps from the Western Wall, killing himself on the stones below the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And the prologue is written from the point of view of an Israeli soldier who's coming onto his post, and he sees and he finds the body. So that's a very specific point of view, somebody watching somebody jump and then finding their body, and then he finds a slip of paper, which kind of advances the plot. And this is the thing, the next thing. So it must advance the plot or demonstrate character. So my prologue, and the reason it's a prologue is it doesn't actually feature the protagonist, and it's a bit earlier. And then the when I say Morgan running, so this is the second book in my Arcane series, and Morgan is basically out for a run when she gets a call from the Ezra Institute, the hospital for people with Jerusalem syndrome. And that's the inciting incident, is the phone call and the decision to go and investigate why people are killing themselves in the name of God. Basically, that's the plot. Why are people killing themselves and others in the name of God? Which, when you think about it, is a bigger question in the world today. But that was the thing I was investigating with that book. So each scene must advance the plot in some way or demonstrate character. And if you demonstrate character, then don't have that in too many scenes in a row, which is often the problem with some literary fiction. It's just like, oh, it's just all about the character and there's no story. But you must advance the plot or show character and add specific details. So the prologue of that book, I have specific details about the Western Wall, the type of, you know, the prayers that are folded and put in between the cracks, the plants that have grown into the wall over thousands of years, the specific details around the smells that the soldier can smell as he walks through the city. These are specific details that will bring the scene alive. So the other thing is Sean Coyne's The Story Grid talks about the value shift of a scene. So there should be some kind of change in the scene. And this doesn't need to be dramatic, okay? This is just like something shifts during the scene. So an example here is, you know, with the prologue, the soldier is just walking to his position at his post at the Western Wall. So the story starts at a plus, you know, is a plus point. So he walks into the square. There's a man in a gown, hospital gown, and he jumps, you know, kind of like an angel, except he crashes and kills himself on the stones. So the shift is then someone's just killed themselves and the blood is running across these ancient stones. It's very evocative. and the shift then is to a negative, because this, in his point of view, he's gone from just another day to dealing with this suicide. And this type of shift in emotional value needs to happen as well. And it doesn't have to be dramatic. It can be an internal shift, a sort of a decision that the character makes, or something else. So whatever your genre, these types of value shifts will come in. And again, we'll talk about that more and in the plotting video. I just want to give you these things to sort of start to think about your own story. So when we get to the more detailed level, you'll understand how it fits in the bigger diagram of story structure. Okay, so coming back to scene versus chapter. So when you read a book, you will find that most books are written, are produced in chapters, but most writers write in scenes. And when we come back to the editing video in particular, I'll be talking about how to turn scenes into chapters. But basically, chapters are the way you organized your finished product. They're not necessarily the way you write, because a scene is almost like a mini story structure in itself. A scene is like, you know, what I've just described with the soldier. You know, it has the climax is the person jumps from the top of the wall, and the denouement is finding the slip of paper in the body's hand, and the sort of I now have to return to the real world and get on with my job. But with a chapter, you can often break a scene. So what I could have done with that prologue, and what I do with most of my scenes when I turn them into chapters, is I will break it. So it could have stopped at the soldier shouts, and it looks like, is the man going to jump or not? So you could cut the chapter at the look, you know, catching the man's eyes, the moment where he makes the decision as to whether to jump or not, what will happen there. So you could split the chapter, and that would be like a cliffhanger, and we'll come back to that later. But the fact is that chapters are an organizational thing for your finished product. They're not necessarily how you write at the beginning. So some books, so James Patterson just does one chapter per scene, and even, you know, some are incredibly short, so he might have like 140 chapters in a book, whereas other authors you'll see might use parts, and they might use different really long chapters. Some of George R. R. Martin's chapters are really long, because his chapters are the name of the character and then a whole chapter written from the perspective of that character, which might involve several scenes. So you can have multiple scenes per chapter. You can, you know, and you could use timestamps, or you can use, you know, you'll see little squiggly things or stars or things to break up scenes within a chapter in a book, so you know that there's a shift in setting, for example. But and then of course you can break a scene across two chapters. But what I want you to consider now is, when you write your first draft, a bit later on when we get to that, you will be writing in scenes. And if you use this kind of checklist, you know, a scene must have a setting, a time and a place, a character and a point of view. It must advance the plot or demonstrate character. It must have specific detail. It must have some kind of conflict, and it must have value shift. Then you'll know the things that need to go into a scene. And when I demonstrate how I use Scrivener, I'll show you how I do that with my novels. But again, don't obsess too much right now. We're going to come back to all of these things. This is just the kind of the first top level view. But this is a question I get quite a lot, so I do have to cover it. How long is a chapter? How many chapters in a book? And these type of questions portray an insecurity about getting it right. And the fact is, this is not the thing that you need to get right. As I've said, you know, James Patterson has 117 chapters in Honeymoon, which is about 75,000 words. So only 641 words per chapter as an average. I just counted a few of them to work that out. But basically, some of the chapters will be longer and some of them are very short and are very pacey. Some of them are only one page, for example. Compare that to The Shining, which is over 100,000 words. It only has 57 chapters. So lots and lots of words in a chapter. And Stephen King tends to do, you know, he's pretty wordy. He's a wordy writer compared to Patterson. So this is the thing. There is no answer to this. It will be up to you. It will be based on genre convention. So have a look at books that are similar to yours. Come back to that. What are the five books that really resonate with you that are similar to the book you want to write? And figure out, you know, how many do they have if this is something that really obsesses you. But I mean, what I tend to do when I'm writing is aim for 2,000 words per scene. And then I will turn that into, that may be one chapter, it may be split chapters, it may be half a chapter. I will organize chapters when I, much later on. I don't do chapters when I write my first draft, I do scenes. Right, so once more, we will be getting into these different things. So we've just gone over structure, the overall design, layout, organisation of your story, and that demonstrates the movement of the story. So that's the thing to come back to if you're like, what is wrong with my story? See if it fits onto that three-act structure. Then we're going to come to plot and character, when we will go into all the different aspects of the novel. And then when we get into writing, we'll look at outlining versus discovery writing and that much more detailed level before we get into the first draft. So I just wanted to give you a hint of what's to come. So for the exercise for this video, I want you to map out the structure of your favorite book or film. So think about your favorite book or film. How does it work with that structure? Just like I did with The Hunger Games, how does it fit? And you only need to necessarily write a couple of lines. You don't need to spend hours and hours on this, but I want you to try and think about a successful, let's put a caveat around your favorite. It needs to be successful in the way that you want to be successful. So, you know, if you want to write a commercial book, then think of a commercial book or film and consider, you know, whether it was a bestseller, because those are the books that tend to resonate. And then if you're ready, if you already have an idea of a story, think about your own story. And does your story map onto the structure? What is missing? What have you got that isn't strong enough? And believe me, we all have those problems. But that is the challenge of writing a book. That is what makes all of our books individual, is we can still take that structure and all do something completely different. So we will be coming back to this, but I will see you in the next video when we will be looking more detail at genre.